entirely foolish smile, it seemed to Sherman, as if she thought something very pleasant had just been expressed by the distinguished gentleman from Great Britain. Inez Beverdage rose up and said,
"We'll have coffee in the other room."
Gradually, without conviction, the hive began to buzz again. On the ride back home, the six-block ride, costing $123.25, which is to say one-half of $246.50 with Mayfair Town Car Inc.'s white-haired driver at the wheel, Judy chattered away. She was bubbling over. Sherman hadn't seen her this animated for more than 2 weeks, since the night she caught him in flagrante telephone with Maria. Tonight, obviously, she had not detected a thing concerning Maria, didn't even know the pretty girl sitting next to her husband at dinner had been named Maria. No, she was in great spirits. She was intoxicated, not by alcohol, alcohol was fattening, but by society. With a pretense of amused detachment, she burbled about the shrewdness with which Inez had chosen her celebrity all-stars. Three titles, Baron Huxfald, Lord Gutt, and Lord Buffing, one ranking politician with a cosmopolitan cachet, Jacques Prudhomme, four giants of arts and letters, Bobby Shafflett, Nunnally Void, Boris Korolev, and Lord Buffing, two designers, Ronald Vine and Barbara Cornaglia, three VIFs, VIFs? Asked Sherman.
"Very important fags," said Judy. "That's what everybody calls them."
The only name Sherman caught was that of the Englishman who had sat to her right, St. John Thomas, and three business titans, Huxfald, Rail Brigham, and Arthur Ruskin. Then she went on about Ruskin. The woman on his left, Madame Prudhomme, wouldn't talk to him, and the woman on his right, Rail Brigham's wife, wasn't interested, and so Ruskin had leaned over and started telling Baron Huxfald about his air charter service in the Middle East.
"Sherman, have you any idea how that man makes his money? He takes Arabs to Mecca on airplanes, 747s, by the tens of thousands, and he's Jewish."
It was the first time she had passed on a piece of chit-chat to him in the sunny vein of yore, since he couldn't remember when. But he was past caring about the life and times of Arthur Ruskin. He could think only of the gaunt and haunted Englishman, Aubrey Buffing. And then Judy said, "What on earth do you suppose got into Lord Buffing? The whole thing was so mortifying." Mortifying indeed, thought Sherman. He started to tell her that Buffing was dying of AIDS, but he was long past the joys of gossip also. "I have no idea," he said. But of course he did. He knew precisely. That mannered, ghostly English voice had been the voice of an oracle. Aubrey Buffing had been speaking straight to him, as if he were a medium dispatched by God himself. Edgar Allan Poe. Poe! The ruin of the dissolute. In the Bronx. The Bronx! The meaningless whirl, the unbridled flesh, the obliteration of home and hearth, and waiting in the last room, the Red Death. Eddie had the door open for them by the time they walked from the Mayfair Town Car sedan to the entrance. Judy sang out, "Hello, Eddie!" Sherman barely looked at him and said nothing at all. He felt dizzy. In addition to being consumed by fear, he was drunk. His eyes darted about the lobby, the street of dreams. He half expected to see the shroud. Chapter 16. Talkin' Irish. Martin's Irish machismo was so icy, Kramer couldn't conceive of him as high-spirited, except possibly while drunk. Even then, he figured, he would be a mean and irritable drunk. But this morning he was in high spirits. His sinister Doberman eyes had become big and bright. He was happy as a child.
"So we're standing there in this lobby with these two doormen," he was saying. "And there's a buzz, and this button lights up, and Jesus Christ, one of these guys, he's running out the door like he's got a wire up his ass, and he's blowing a whistle and waving his arms for a cab."
He looked straight at Bernie Fitzgibbon as he told this tale. The four of them, Martin, Fitzgibbon, Goldberg, and himself, were in Fitzgibbon's office. Fitzgibbon, as befitted a homicide bureau chief in the district attorney's office, was a slender, athletic Irishman of the black Irish stripe, with a square jaw, thick black hair, dark eyes, and what Kramer called a locker-room grin. A locker-room grin was quick, but never ingratiating. Fitzgibbon no doubt smiled readily at Martin's story and its boorish details, because Martin was a particular type of tough little harp, and Fitzgibbon understood and valued the breed. There were two Irishmen in the room, Martin and Fitzgibbon, and two Jews, Goldberg and himself. But to all intents and purposes, there were four Irishmen. "I'm still Jewish," thought Kramer, "but not in this room." All the cops turned Irish, the Jewish cops like Goldberg, but also the Italian cops, the Latin cops, and the black cops. The black cops, even. Nobody understood the police commissioners, who were usually black, because their skin hid the fact that they had turned Irish. The same was true of assistant district attorneys in the Homicide Bureau. You were supposed to turn Irish. The Irish were disappearing from New York, so far as the general population was concerned. In politics, the Irish, who 20 years ago still ran the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, and much of Manhattan, were down to one seedy little district over on the west side of Manhattan, over where all the unused piers rusted in the Hudson River. Every Irish policeman Kramer met, including Martin, lived out on Long Island, or someplace like Dobbs Ferry, and commuted to the city. Bernie Fitzgibbon and Jimmy Coey were dinosaurs. Everybody moving up in the Bronx district attorney's office was Jewish or Italian, and yet the Irish stamp was on the police department and on the homicide bureau of the DA's office, and it would probably be there forever. Irish machismo. That was the dour madness that gripped them all. They called themselves harps and donkeys, the Irish did. Donkeys. They used the word themselves, in pride, but also as an admission. They understood the word. Irish bravery was not the bravery of the lion, but the bravery of the donkey. As a cop, or as an assistant district attorney in homicide, no matter what kind of stupid fix you got yourself into, you never backed off. You held your ground. That was what was scary about even the smallest and most insignificant of the breed. Once they took a position, they were ready to fight. To deal with them, you had to be willing to fight also, and not that many people on this poor globe were willing to fight. The other side of it was loyalty. When one of them got in a jam, the others never broke ranks. Well, that wasn't completely true, but the game had to be pretty far gone before the Irish started looking out for number one. The cops were like that, and assistant DAs in homicide were supposed to be like that. Loyalty was loyalty, and Irish loyalty was a monolith, indivisible, the code of the donkey. And every Jew, every Italian, every black, every Puerto Rican internalized that code and became a stone donkey himself. The Irish liked to entertain one another with Irish war stories, so that when Donkey Fitzgibbon and Donkey Goldberg listened to Donkey Martin, all they lacked was booze, so they could complete the picture by getting drunk and sentimental, or drunk and in a brutal rage. No, thought Kramer, they don't need alcohol. They're high on what tough, undiluted motherfuckers they are.
I asked one of the doormen about it, said Martin. I mean, we had lots of time. This fucking McCoy makes us wait down in the lobby for 15 minutes. Anyway, on every floor, beside the elevator, they got two buttons. One is for the elevator, and the other is for cabs. You push the button, and this little shitball runs out in the street blowing his whistle and waving his arms. So anyway, we finally get in the elevator, and it dawns on me I don't know what floor the fucking guy lives on. So I stick my head out the door, and I says to the doorman, "What button do I push?" And he says, "We'll send you up there. We'll send you up there. You can push all the buttons you want inside the elevator, and it don't mean shit. One of the doormen has to push the button on his panel out by the door. Even if you live in the fucking place and you want to go visit somebody else, you can't just get on the elevator and push somebody else's floor. Not that the place strikes me as the kind of place where they just drop by to shoot the shit. Anyway, this guy McCoy's on the 10th floor. The door opens, and you step out into this little room. It don't open up on a hall. It opens up in this little room, and there's only one door. On that floor, the elevator is just for his fucking apartment.
You've lived a sheltered life, Marty, said Bernie Fitzgibbon.
Not fucking sheltered enough, if you ask me, said Martin. We ring the bell, and a maid in a uniform opens the door. She's Puerto Rican or South American or something. This hall you walk into, there's all this marble and wood paneling and one of those big staircases that goes up like this, like something in a fucking movie. So we cool our heels on the marble floor for a while until the guy figures he's made us wait the proper length of time, and then he comes down the stairs, very slowly, with his fucking chin, I swear to Christ, with his fucking chin up in the air. You catch that, Davy?
Yeah, said Goldberg. He snorted with amusement.
What's he look like? Asked Fitzgibbon.
He's tall, got the gray suit, got his chin up in the air. Your Wall Street asshole. Not a bad-looking guy, about 40.
How did he react to you guys being there?
He was pretty cool about the whole thing at first, said Martin. He invited us into this library, I guess it was. It wasn't very big, but you should have seen this fucking shit up around the ceiling. He waved his hand in a sweeping motion. There's all these fucking people carved out of wood, like crowds of people on the sidewalk, and these shops and shit in the background. You never seen anything like it. So we're sitting there, and I'm telling him how this is a routine check of cars of this make with this license plate and so on, and he's saying, yeah, he heard something about the case on television, and yeah, he has a Mercedes with a license number that begins with R, and it sure is a fucking coincidence, all right. And I mean, I figure, well, this is just another jerk-off name on this fucking jerk-off list they handed us. I mean, if you want to figure out the least likely character you can think of who would be driving up fucking Bruckner Boulevard in the Bronx at night, this is the guy. I mean, I'm practically apologizing to the guy for wasting his fucking time. And then I ask him if we can take a look at it, and he says, when? And I says, now. And that was all it took. I mean, if he said, it's in his shop, or my wife's got it, or any goddamn thing. I don't know if I'd have even come back to check it out. It all looks so fucking unlikely. But he gets this look on his face, and his lips start trembling, and he starts talking this double talk about how he don't know, and what's the routine. But it's mainly the look on his face. I look at Davy, and he looked at me, and we both saw the same goddamn thing. Ain't that the truth, Davy?
Yeah. Suddenly the bitch comes out in him. You could see it coming out.
I've seen people like this before, said Martin. He don't like this shit at all. He's not a bad guy. Looks a little stuck up, but he's probably a nice enough guy. He's got a wife and a kid. He's got this fucking apartment. He ain't got the heart for this shit. He ain't got the heart for being on the wrong side of the law. I don't care who you are. Sometime in your life, you're going to be on the wrong side of the law. And some people got the heart for it, and some don't.
He don't have the heart for you sitting on his fucking desk, said Goldberg, laughing.
His desk? Said Fitzgibbon.
Oh, yeah, said Martin, chuckling at the recollection. Well, the thing is, I see the guy starting to come apart, and I say to myself, well, shit, I ain't read him his fucking rights yet, so I better do that. So I'm trying to be real casual about it, and I'm telling him how much we appreciate his cooperation and all, and he don't have to say anything if he don't want to, and he's entitled to a lawyer and so forth, and now I'm thinking ahead. How am I going to say, if you can't afford an attorney, the state will provide you with one free of charge, and make that sound casual, when the fucking carvings on the wall cost more than a fucking 18B lawyer makes in a year. So I figure I'll throw in the old move-over maneuver for good measure, and I stand right over him. He's sitting down at this big desk, and I look at him like, you're not going to do a chicken shit thing like keeping your mouth shut just because I'm reading you your rights, are you?
It was worse than that, said Goldberg. Marty starts sitting on the edge of the guy's fucking desk.
What did he do? Asked Fitzgibbon.
Nothing at first, said Martin. He knows something's up. There ain't no way you can just say, by the way, and read somebody its rights like you're just passing the time. But he's confused. I can see his eyes getting bigger and bigger. He's double-talking like a son of a bitch. Then he gets up, and he says he wants to talk to a lawyer. The funny thing is, here he starts coming apart when we ask him about the car, and then we go by and see the car, and it's clean. There's not a mark on it.
How did you find his car?
That was simple. He told us he kept it in a garage. So I figured if you got as much money as this son of a bitch has, you're going to keep your car in the nearest garage. So I asked the doorman where's the nearest parking garage. That's all. Didn't even mention McCoy.
And the garage, they just showed you the car?
Yeah, I just flashed the badge, and Davy stood on the other side of him and stared holes in his head. You know, a mean Jew looks a lot meaner than a mean harp.
Goldberg beamed. He took this as a great compliment.
The guy says, "Which car?" said Goldberg. Turns out they keep two cars in the garage, the Mercedes and a Mercury station wagon. And it costs $410 a month to keep a car in there. It's posted on the wall, $820 a month for two cars. That's $200 more than I pay for my whole fucking house in Dix Hills.
So the guy shows you the car? Asked Fitzgibbon.
He tells us where it is and says, "Help yourself," said Goldberg. I get the idea he's not too crazy about McCoy.
Well, he don't go out of his way to look out for him, said Martin. I asked him if the car was used Tuesday a week ago in the evening, and he says, oh, sure, he remembers it very well. McCoy takes it out about 6 and comes back about 10, looking like a mess.
Nice to have people looking out for your interests, said Goldberg.
Alone? Asked Fitzgibbon.
That's what he said, said Martin.
So you feel sure this is the guy?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, said Fitzgibbon. Then how do we get a case?
We got the start of one now, said Martin. We know he was driving his car that night.
Give us 20 more minutes with the fucker and we'll get the rest, said Goldberg. He's got the bitch coming out of him already.
I wouldn't count on that, said Fitzgibbon. Although you can try. You know, we really ain't got shit. We got no witnesses. The kid himself is out of it. We don't even know where it happened. Not only that, the kid comes into the hospital the night it happens and he don't say anything about getting hit by a car.
A light began to dawn. Kramer broke in.
Maybe he was already gaga.
A radiance emanated from this erstwhile piece of shit. We know he took a pretty good shot to the head.
Maybe, said Fitzgibbon. But that don't give me anything to move with, and I'm telling you, Abe is gonna wanna move. He's not happy about that demonstration yesterday. White justice is white justice. That was all over the newspapers, and it was on TV.
And it was bullshit, said Goldberg. We were there, a couple dozen pickets, half of them the usual nutballs, this Reva Wutsis and her elves, and the rest of them were rubberneckers. Try telling that to Abe. He saw it on TV like everybody else.
Well, you know, said Kramer, this guy McCoy sounds like somebody we can smoke out, maybe.
Smoke out?
Yeah, I'm just thinking out loud now, but maybe by going public with it.
Going public? Said Fitzgibbon. Are you kidding? With what?
The guy gets squirrely when two cops come to his apartment to question him, and he was driving his car on the night the kid was hit? You know what that adds up to?
Nothing.
I said I was just thinking out loud.
Yeah, well, do me a favor. Don't think out loud that way in front of Abe. He's just liable to take you seriously.
Reed Street was one of those old streets down near the courthouses and City Hall. It was a narrow street, and the buildings on either side, office buildings and light industry lofts with cast iron columns and architraves, kept it in a dismal gloaming, even on a bright spring day like this. Gradually, the buildings in this area, which was known as Tribeca, for Triangle Below Canal Street, were being renovated as offices and apartments, but the area retained an irreducible grime. On the fourth floor of an old cast-iron building, Sherman walked down a corridor with a dingy tile floor. Halfway down the corridor was a plastic plate incised with the names Dershkin, Bellavita, Fishbine, and Schlossel. Sherman opened the door and found himself in a tiny and overpoweringly bright, glassed-in vestibule, tended by a Latin woman who sat behind a glass partition. He gave his name and asked to see Mr. Killian, and the woman pressed a buzzer. A glass door led to a larger, even brighter space with white walls. The lights overhead were so strong Sherman kept his head down. An orange industrial cord carpet covered the floor. Sherman squinted, trying to avoid the ferocious wattage. Just ahead, on the floor, he could make out the base of a couch. The base was made of white formica. Pale tan leather cushions were on top of it. Sherman sat down, and his tailbone immediately slid forward.
The seat seemed to tilt the wrong way. His shoulder blades hit the back cushions, which rested against a slab of formica set perpendicular to the base. Gingerly, he lifted his head. There was another couch across from him. On it were two men and a woman. One man had on a blue-and-white running suit with two big panels of electric blue leather in front. The other man wore a trench coat made of some dull, dusty, grainy hide, elephant perhaps, with shoulders cut so wide he seemed gigantic. The woman wore a black leather jacket, also cut very large, black leather pants, and black boots that folded down below the knee like a pirate's. All three of them were squinting, just as Sherman was. They also kept sliding forward and then twitching and squirming back up, and their leather clothes rustled and squeaked. The leather people. Jammed together on the couch, they resembled an elephant tormented by flies. A man entered the reception area from an inner hallway, a tall, thin, bald man with bristling eyebrows. He wore a shirt and a tie, but no jacket, and he had a revolver in a holster high on his left hip. He gave Sherman the sort of dead smile a doctor might give in a waiting room if he didn't want to be detained. Then he went back inside. Voices from the inner hallway, a man and a woman. The man appeared to be pushing the woman forward. The woman took little steps and looked back at him over her shoulder. The man was tall and slender, probably in his late 30s. He wore a double-breasted navy blue suit with a pale blue overplaid and a striped shirt with a stiff white collar. The collar had an exaggerated spread, very much a Sharpie's look, to Sherman's way of thinking. He had a lean face, a delicate face, you might have said, had it not been for his nose, which appeared to have been broken. The woman was young, no more than 25, all breasts, bright red lips, raging hair, and sultry makeup, popping out of a black turtleneck sweater. She wore black pants and teetered atop a pair of black spike-heel shoes. At first, their voices were muffled. Then the woman's voice became louder and the man's became lower. It was the classic case. The man wants to confine matters to a quiet private argument, but the woman decides to play one of her trump cards, which is making a scene. There is making a scene, and there is tears. This was making a scene. The woman's voice became louder and louder, and at last the man's rose too.
"But you gotta,"
the woman said. "But I don't gotta, Irene.
What am I supposed to do? Rot?"
"You supposed to pay your bills like everybody else," he said, mimicking her. "You already beat me for half my fee, and then you keep asking me to do things that could get me disbarred."
"You don't care."
"It ain't that I don't care, Irene. It's that I don't care anymore. You don't pay your bills. Don't look at me like that. You're on your own."
"But you gotta. What happens if they rearrest me?"
"You should have thought of that, Irene. What did I tell you the first time you walked into this office? I told you two things. I told you, Irene, I'm not going to be your friend. I'm going to be your lawyer. But I'm going to do more for you than your friends. And I said, Irene, you know why I do this? I do it for money. And then I said, Irene, remember those two things. Isn't that right? Didn't I say that?"
"I can't go back there,"
she said. She lowered her heavy tropical twilight eyelids, and then her whole head. Her lower lip trembled. Her head and the raging hair shook. So did her shoulders. The tears. "Ah, for Christ's sake, Irene, come on." The tears. "All right, look. I'll find out if they're going after you on a 22031, and I'll represent you on rearrangement if they are, but that's it." The tears. Victorious, even after these many millennia. The woman nodded like a penitent child. She walked out through the blazing waiting room. Her bottom bobbed in a glossy black shimmer. One of the leather men looked at Sherman and smiled man to man and said, "Ay, caramba." On this alien terrain, Sherman felt obliged to smile back. The Sharpie came into the reception room and said, "Mr. McCoy, I'm Tom Killian." Sherman stood up and shook hands.
Killian didn't shake hands very firmly. Sherman thought of the two detectives. He followed Killian down a hallway with more spotlights. Killian's office was small, modern, and grim. It had no window. But at least it wasn't bright. Sherman looked at the ceiling. Of the 9 recessed spotlights, 7 had been unscrewed or allowed to burn out. Sherman said, "The light's out there." He shook his head and didn't bother to finish the sentence.
"Yeah, I know," said Killian. "That's what you get when you fuck your decorator. The guy who leased this place, he brought in this number, and she thought the building was gloomy. She put in, I mean, lights. The woman had Watt fever. The place is supposed to remind you of Key Biscayne. That's what she said."
Sherman didn't hear anything after "fuck your decorator." As a master of the universe, he took a masculine pride in the notion that he could handle all sides of life. But now, like many respectable American males before him, he was discovering that all sides of life were colorful mainly when you were in the audience. Fuck your decorator. How could he let any decision affecting his life be made by this sort of person in this sort of atmosphere? He had called in sick, that lamest, weakest, most sniveling of life's small lies, to Pearson Pierce, for this itching slum of the legal world. Killian motioned toward a chair, a modern chair with a curved chrome frame and Chinese red upholstery, and Sherman sat down. The back was too low. There was no way to get comfortable. Killian's chair behind the desk didn't look much better. Killian let out a sigh and rolled his eyes again.
"You heard me conferring with my client, Miss..."
He made a curve in the air with his cupped hand.
"I did, yes." "Whatever you add, criminal law in its basic form with all of the elements."
At first Sherman thought the man was talking this way as further mimicry of the woman who had just left. Then he realized it wasn't her accent. It was Killian's own. The starched dandy who sat before him had a New York street accent, full of dropped consonants and tortured vowels. Nevertheless, he had lifted Sherman's spirits a notch or two by indicating that he knew Sherman was new to the world of criminal law and that he existed on a plateau far above it.
"What sort of case?" asked Sherman. "Drugs? Who else can afford a trial lawyer for 8 weeks?
Then, without any transition, he said,
"Freddie told me a problem. I also been reading about the case in the tabloids. Freddie's a great man, but he has too much class to read the tabloids. I read 'em. So why don't you tell me what actually happened?"
To his surprise, once he got started, Sherman found it easy to tell his story in this place, to this man. Like a priest, his confessor, this dandy with a fighter's nose, was from another order. Every now and then a plastic intercom box on Killian's desk would give an electronic beep, and the receptionist's faintly Latin voice would say, "Mr. Killian? Mr. Scanessi on 3-0, or Mr. Rothblatt on 3-1, and Killian would say, "Tell him I'll call him back," and Sherman would resume. But then the machine beeped and the voice said, "Mr. Leong on 3-0. "Tell him I'll take it." Killian gave his hand a deprecating flap in the air as if to say, "This is nothing compared to what we're talking about, but I'll have to talk to this person for half a second."
"Hey, Lee," said Killian. What are you? "No kidding. Hey, Lee, I was just reading a book about you. Well, not about you, but about you Leongs. Would I kid you? What do you think? I want a hatchet in my back."
Sherman grew increasingly irritated. At the same time, he was impressed. Apparently, Killian was representing one of the defendants in the Chinatown voting scandal. Finally, Killian hung up and turned to Sherman and said,
"So you took the car back to the garage, and you exchanged a few words with the attendant, and you walked home."
This was no doubt to show that he hadn't been distracted by the interruption. Sherman kept going, concluding with the visit of the two detectives, Martin and Goldberg, to his apartment. Killian leaned forward and said,
"All right. The first thing you gotta understand is from now on you gotta keep your mouth shut. You understand? You got nothing to gain, nothing, by talking about this. To anybody. I don't care who it is. All that's gonna happen is you're gonna get jerked around some more like you did by these two cops.
What should I have done? They were in the building. They knew I was upstairs. If I refused to talk to them, that would be like a clear indication that I had something to hide.
All you had to do was tell them, gentlemen, it's nice to meet you. You're conducting an investigation. I have absolutely no experience in this area, so I'm going to turn you over to my attorney. Good evening. Don't let the doorknob hit you in the back on your way out.
But even that, it's better than what happened, right? As a matter of fact, they would have probably figured, well, here's this Park Avenue swell who's too busy or too above it all to talk to characters like us. He's got people who do things like that for him.
It wouldn't have prejudiced your case at all, probably. From now on, it sure as hell won't. He started chuckling.
The guy actually read your rights there, huh? I wish I could have seen it. The dumb fuck probably lives in a two-family in Massapequa, and he's sitting there in an apartment on Park Avenue in the 70s, and he's got to inform you that if you are unable to afford a lawyer, the state will provide you one. He's got to read you the whole thing.
Sherman was chilled by the man's detached amusement. All right, he said. But what does it mean?
It means they're trying to get evidence for a criminal charge.
What kind?
What kind of evidence or what kind of charge?
What kind of charge?
They have several possibilities, assuming Lamb don't die.
Don't.
There's reckless endangerment.
Is that the same as reckless driving?
No, it's a felony. It's a fairly serious felony. Or, if they really want to get hard-nosed about it, they could work on a theory of assault with a dangerous weapon, meaning the car. If Lamb dies, that creates two more possibilities. Manslaughter is one, and criminally negligent homicide is the other. Although all the time I was in the DA's office up there, I never heard of charging anybody with criminally negligent homicide unless there was a drunk driving involved. On top of that, they got leaving the scene of an accident and failure to report an accident. Both felonies.
But since I wasn't driving the car at the time this fellow was hit, can they bring any of these charges against me?
Before we get to that, let me explain something to you. Maybe they can't bring charges against anybody.
They can't? Sherman felt his entire nervous system quicken at this first sign of hope.
You looked your car over pretty carefully, right? No dents, no blood, no tissue, no broken glass, right?
That's right.
It's pretty obvious the kid wasn't hit very hard. The emergency room treated him for a broken wrist and let him go, right?
Yes.
The fact of the matter is, you don't even know if your car hit him, do you?
Well, I did hear something.
With all the shit that was going on at that moment, that could have been anything. You heard something. You didn't see anything. You don't really know, do you?
Well, that's true.
You beginning to see why I don't want you to talk to anybody?
Yes.
And I mean anybody, okay? Now, here's another thing. Maybe it wasn't your car that hit him. Did that possibility ever occur to you? Maybe it wasn't any car. You don't know. And they don't know. The cops don't know. These stories in the newspaper are very strange. Here's this big case, supposedly, but nobody knows where this cockamamie hit-and-run supposed to have taken place. Bruckner Boulevard. Bruckner Boulevard's 5 miles long. They got no witnesses. What the kid told his mother is hearsay. It don't mean a thing. They have no description of a driver. Even if they could establish that it was your car that hit him, they can't arrest a car. One of the garage attendants could have loaned it to his sister-in-law's nephew so he could go up to Fordham Road to kiss his girlfriend goodnight. They don't know, and you don't know. As a matter of fact, stranger things have happened.
But suppose the other boy comes forward. I swear to you, there was a second boy, a big, powerful fellow.
I believe you. It was a setup. They were going to take you off. Yeah, he could come forward, but it sounds to me like he has his reasons not to.
Judging by this story the mother tells, the kid didn't mention him either.
Yes, said Sherman, but he could. I swear, I'm beginning to feel as if I should preempt the situation and take the initiative and go to the police with Maria, Mrs. Ruskin, and just tell them exactly what happened. I mean, I don't know about the law, but I feel morally certain that I did the right thing and that she did the right thing in the situation we were in.
Aye, said Killian. You Wall Street honchos really are gamblers.
What are you?
Killian was grinning. Sherman stared at him in astonishment. Killian must have detected it, because he put on a perfectly serious face.
You got any idea what the DA'd do if you just walked in and said, yeah, it was me and my girlfriend who lives on Fifth Avenue in my car? They'd devour you. Devour you.
Why?
The case is already a political football, and they got nothing to go on. Reverend Bacon is yelling about it. It's on TV. The City Light has gone bananas over it, and it's putting a lot of pressure on Abe Weiss, who has an election coming up.
I know Weiss very well. There is no real world to Abe Weiss. There's only what's on TV and in the newspapers. But I'll tell you something else. They wouldn't give you a break even if no one was watching.
Why not?
You know what you do all day long when you work in the DA's office? You prosecute people named Tiffany Latour and LeBaron Courtney and Mustafa Shabazz and Camilo Rodriguez. You get so you're dying to get your hands on somebody with something on the ball. And if somebody gives you a couple like you and your friend Mrs. Ruskin, hey, Biscuit City.
The man seemed to have a horrible nostalgic enthusiasm for such a catch.
What would happen? For a start, there's no way in the world they wouldn't arrest you, and if I know Weiss, he'd make a big show of it. They might not be able to hold you very long, but it would be extremely unpleasant. That's guaranteed.
Sherman tried to imagine it. He couldn't. His spirits hit bottom. He let out a big sigh.
Now you see why I don't want you to talk to anybody. You get the picture?
Yes.
But look, I'm not trying to depress you. My job right now is not to defend you, but to keep you from even having to be defended.
I mean, that's assuming you decide to have me represent you. I'm not even going to talk about a fee at this point, because I don't know what this is going to involve. If you're lucky, I'll find out this is a bullshit case.
How can you find out that?
The head of the Homicide Bureau in the Bronx DA's office is a guy I started out with up there, Bernie Fitzgibbon.
And he'll tell you?
I think he will. We're friends. He's a donkey, just like me.
A donkey?
An Irishman.
But is that wise, letting them know I've hired a lawyer and I'm worried? Won't that put ideas in their heads?
Christ, they already got ideas in their head, and they know you're worried. If you weren't worried after those two meatballs came to see you, there'd have to be something wrong with you. But I can take care of that. What you ought to start thinking about is your friend Mrs. Ruskin.
That was what Freddie said.
Freddie was right. If I'm going to take this case, I want to talk to her, and the sooner the better.
You think she'd be willing to make a statement?
A statement?
A sworn statement we could have witnessed.
Before I talked to Freddie, I would have said yes. Now I don't know. If I try to get her to make a sworn statement in a legal setting, I don't know what she'll do.
Well, one way or another, I want to talk to her. Can you get a hold of her? I don't mind calling her myself, as far as that goes.
No, it would be better if I did.
One thing is, you don't want her going around talking, either. Talking.
Freddie tells me you went to the Yale Law School. When were you there?
The late 70s, said Killian.
What did you think of it?
It was okay. Nobody there knew what the fuck I was talking about. You might as well be from Afghanistan as Sunnyside, Queens, but I liked it. It's a nice place. It's easy, as law schools go.
They don't try to bury you in details. They give you the scholarly view, the overview. You get the grand design. They're very good at giving you that. Yale is terrific for anything you want to do, so long as it don't involve people with sneakers, guns, dope, lust, or sloth.
Chapter 17. The Favor Bank. Over the intercom came the secretary's voice.
I got Irv Stone on the line from Channel 1.
Without a word to Bernie Fitzgibbon, Milt Lovell, or Kramer, Abe Weiss stopped in the middle of a sentence and picked up the telephone. Without a hello or any other preliminary remark, he said into the mouthpiece,
What I gotta do with you guys?
It was the voice of a tired and disappointed parent.
You're supposed to be a news organization in the most important city in the country, right? And what's the most serious problem in the most important city in the country? Drugs. And what's the worst of the drugs? Crack. Am I right? And we bring in grand jury indictments against three of the biggest crack dealers in the Bronx, and what do you guys do? Nothing. Let me finish. We bring all three of them into central booking at 10 o'clock in the morning, and where are you guys? Nowhere. Wait a minute, my ass.
No longer the saddened parent, now the irate neighbor on the floor below.
You got no excuse, Irv. You guys are lazy. You're afraid you're gonna miss a meal at the Cote Basque. One day you're gonna wake up... What? Don't give me that, Irv. The only thing wrong with those crack dealers is they're black and they're from the Bronx. What do you want, Vanderbilt, Astor, and Wriston?
He didn't seem too sure about Wriston.
One day you're gonna wake up and realize you're out of it. This is America up here in the Bronx, Irv, modern-day America, and there's black people in modern-day America, whether you know it or not. Manhattan's an offshore boutique. This is America. This is the laboratory of human relations. This is the experiment in urban living. What do you mean, huh, about the Lamb case? What's that got to do with this? Big deal, you covered a story in the Bronx. What do you got, a quota?
He hung up. No goodbye. He turned to Fitzgibbon, who sat to one side of the district attorney's enormous desk. Kramer and Lovell sat on either side of Fitzgibbon. Weiss put his hands up in the air as if he were holding a medicine ball over his head.
They're screaming about crack every night, and we bring in indictments against three major dealers, and he's telling me there's no story in it. It's routine stuff.
Kramer found himself shaking his head to indicate how saddened he was by the obstinacy of television newsmen. Weiss's press secretary, Milt Lovell, a skinny little man with a grisly gray beard and big eyes, swiveled his head in a state of advanced disbelief. Only Bernie Fitzgibbon took this news without the slightest locomotor reaction.
"You see?" said Weiss.
He jerked his thumb toward the telephone without looking at it.
"I try to talk to this guy about drug indictments, and he throws the Lamb case in my face."
The district attorney looked extremely angry. But then, every time Kramer had laid eyes on him, he had looked angry. Weiss was about 48. He had a full head of light brown hair, a narrow face, and a strong, lean jaw with a scar on one side. There was nothing wrong with that. Abe Weiss was one of a long line of New York district attorneys whose careers had been based on appearing on television and announcing the latest paralyzing wallop to the solar plexus of crime in the seething metropolis. Weiss, the good Captain Ahab, might be the object of jokes. But he was wired into the power, and the power flowed through him, and his office, with its paneled walls and outsized old wooden furniture and its American flag on a stand, was a command post of the power, and Kramer tingled with the excitement of being called in on a summit meeting like this.
"Some way," said Weiss. "We gotta get out in front of this case. Right now I'm stuck in a position where all I can do is react. You must have seen this coming, Bernie, and you didn't warn me. Kramer here talked to Bacon a week ago, it must have been."
"But that's just the point, Abe," said Fitzgibbon. "That's..." Weiss pushed a button on his desk, and Fitzgibbon stopped talking because obviously the district attorney's mind had departed the immediate vicinity. He was looking at a television screen on the other side of the room. Bulging from the stately paneled wall, like a high-tech goiter, was a bank of four television sets and stacks of steely boxes with steely knobs and black glass dials and green diode lights and a nest of electrical cords. Rows of video cassettes stretched across the shelves behind the television sets, where books had once been. If Abe Weiss, or anything concerning Abe Weiss, or anything concerning crime and punishment in the Bronx, was on television, Abe Weiss wanted it on tape. One of the sets flared to life. Just the picture, no sound. A cloth banner filled the screen.
"Johannex Bronx. Weiss justice is apartheid justice."
Then came a cluster of angry faces, white and black, shot from below so that they looked like an overwhelming mob.
For Christ's sake, who the hell's that? Asked Weiss.
That's Channel 7, said Milt Bubble.
Kramer looked at Lubble.
But they weren't even there, Channel 7. There was only Channel 1.
He said it in a low voice, to indicate he was daring to talk only to the district attorney's press secretary. He wasn't presuming to jump into the general conversation.
You didn't see this? Said Lubble. This was last night. After I ran it, the rest of them got hot for the story, so they had another demonstration last night.
You're kidding, said Kramer.
Ran on 5 or 6 channels. Smart move.
Weiss pushed another button on his desk, and a second screen came on. On the first screen, heads continued to flare up and vanish, flare up and vanish. On the second, 3 male musicians with bony faces and huge Adam's apples and 1 woman, in a dark and smoky back alley, MTV, a whirring sound. The musicians split up into vibrating stripes. The video cassette kicks in. A moon-faced young man with a microphone under his chin, out in front of the Poe projects. The usual pack of teenagers are cutting up in the background.
Mort Selden, Channel 5, said Weiss.
Right, said Milt Bubble.
Weiss hit another button. A third screen lit up. The musicians were back on the smoky street. The woman had dark lips, like Shelley Thomas's. The most exquisite yearning came over Kramer. The musicians turned into jittery stripes again. A man with Latin features.
Roberto Alvidado, said Lubble.
The man held a microphone in the face of an angry black woman. In no time, there were 3 sets of heads flaring and vanishing, casting their toxic wave glow upon the carved wood. Weiss said to Fitzgibbon,
"You realize that's all that was on the news last night, the Lamb case? And all Milt's done all morning is take calls from reporters and these goddamn people wanting to know what we're doing."
"But that's ridiculous, Abe," said Fitzgibbon. What are we supposed to do? We're prosecutors, and the cops haven't even made an arrest yet.
Bacon's cute, said Lubble. He's cute. Oh, he's a cutie. He says the cops have talked to the kid's mother, and we've talked to the kid's mother, and for some bullshit reason we're conspiring to do nothing. We don't care about black people in the projects.
All at once, Weiss turned a baleful eye upon Kramer, and Kramer braced.
Kramer, I want you to tell me something. Did you really tell the kid's mother that her information was useless?
No, sir, I certainly did not.
Kramer realized that his answer sounded a bit too frantic.
The only thing I said was, I said that what her son said to her was hearsay in terms of a prosecution, and what we really needed was witnesses. And she should let us know immediately if she heard of anyone who saw what happened. That's all I said. I didn't say what she told me was useless at all, just the opposite. I thanked her for it. I don't know how anybody could twist it around like that.
And all the while he was thinking, why did I have to play it so cool with the woman, to impress Martin and Goldberg so they wouldn't think I was being soft, so they would regard me as properly Irish? Why couldn't I have been a good, sympathetic Jew? Now look at the fix I'm in. He wondered if Weiss would throw him off the case. But Weiss just nodded ruefully and said,
"Yeah, I know. But just remember, you can't always be logical with..."
He decided not to finish the sentence. He shifted his gaze to Fitzgibbon.
"Bacon can say any goddamn thing he wants to, and I have to sit here and say, my hands are tied."
"I hope you realize, Abe, these demonstrations are pure bullshit. A dozen of Bacon's boys and another couple of dozen of the usual fruitcakes, the monolithic Socialist Labor Party, whatever. Right, Larry?"
"The night I was there, yeah," said Kramer.
But something told him not to play down the importance of the demonstrations, so he motioned toward the television screens and said,
"But I tell you, it looks like there was a much bigger crowd last night."
"Well, sure," said Lubble. "It's the old self-fulfilling prophecy. Once it's on TV and all over the newspapers, people figure it's important. They figure they gotta get excited about it. The old self-fulfilling prophecy."
"Anyway," said Weiss, "what's the situation? What about this guy McCoy? What do we got on him? These 2 cops, what are their names?"
"Martin and Goldberg," said Fitzgibbon.
"They say this is the guy, right?"
"Yeah."
"They're good men?"
"Martin's got a lot of experience.
said Fitzgibbon. "But he's not infallible. Just because this guy got so worked up, that don't necessarily mean he did anything."
"Park Avenue," said Weiss. "His old man ran Dunning, Spungett, and Leach. Milt found his name in a couple of social columns, and his wife's an interior decorator."
Weiss sank back in his chair and smiled, the way one smiles over impossible dreams.
"That sure would put an end to this shit about white justice."
"Abe," said the Irish cold shower Fitzgibbon, "we got zip on the guy so far.
Is there any way we can bring him in for questioning? We know he was driving his car the night the thing happened."
"He's got a lawyer now, Abe. Tommy Killian, in fact."
"Tommy? I wonder how the hell he found Tommy. How do you know that?"
"Tommy called me up, said he represented the guy, wanted to know why the cops were asking him questions."
"What did you tell him?"
"I said the guy's car matches the description of the car we're looking for, so they're trying to check it out."
"What did he say to that?"
"He said they got a bullshit description based on hearsay."
"What did you say?"
"I said we also got a kid in the hospital likely to die, and the cops are investigating with the information they have."
"What's the kid's situation? Any change in his condition?"
"Nah, he's still in a coma, in the intensive care unit. He's living on tubes."
"Any chance he'll regain consciousness?"
"From what they told me, it can happen, but it don't mean anything. They can drift in, but they drift right back out. Besides, he can't talk. He's breathing from a tube down his throat."
"But maybe he can point," said Weiss.
"Point?"
"Yeah. I got an idea."
A far-off look. The distant gaze of inspiration.
"We take a picture of McCoy over to the hospital. Milt found one in one of these magazines."
Weiss handed Bernie Fitzgibbon a page out of some kind of social weekly called W. The page was mostly pictures of grinning people. The men had on tuxedos. The women were all teeth and gaunt faces. Kramer leaned over to have a look. One picture had been circled by a red marker. A man and a woman, both grinning, in evening dress. Look at them. The wasps. The man had a narrow, pointed nose. His head was thrown back, which brought out his big patrician chin. Such a confident, arrogant smile. The woman looked wasp, too, but in a different way. She had that tight, neat, proper, composed look that immediately makes you wonder what's wrong with what you're wearing or what you just said. The caption said, "Sherman and Judy McCoy." They were at some sort of charity event. Here on floor 6M of the island fortress, when you heard a name like Sherman McCoy, you naturally assumed the person was black. But these were the originals, the wasps. Kramer hardly ever saw them except in this form, in pictures, and the pictures showed him bland, stiff-necked aliens with pointed noses whom God, in his perversity, had favored with so much. This was no longer a conscious thought in words, however. By now it was a reflex. Weiss was saying,
"We take this picture of McCoy and three or four other people, three or four other white guys over there, and we put him by his bed. He comes to and he points to McCoy's picture. He keeps pointing."
Bernie Fitzgibbon looked at Weiss as if he were waiting for a clue, a tip, that this was only a little joke.
"Maybe it's worth a try," said Weiss.
"Who's gonna witness all this?" said Fitzgibbon.
"A nurse, a doctor, whoever's there. Then we go over and take a proper dying declaration."
Fitzgibbon said, "Proper? How? I don't believe what I'm hearing, Abe. Some poor gawk with a tube down his throat pointing at a picture? That would never stand up."
"I know that, Bernie. I just want to bring the guy in. Then we can relax and do the right thing."
"Abe, Jesus Christ, never mind the legal side of it for a minute. You're going to put a picture of a Wall Street investment banker and a bunch of other white guys on the kid's bedside table while he's fucking dying? Suppose he comes to, and he looks at the fucking table, and here's half a dozen middle-aged white men in suits and ties staring at him. The fucking kid's going to stroke out for sure. He's going to say, 'Holy shit,' and give up the fucking ghost. I mean, have a fucking heart, Abe." Weiss let out a great sigh and seemed to deflate before Kramer's eyes.
"Yeah, you're right. It's too wild."
Fitzgibbon cut a glance at Kramer. Kramer didn't bat an eye. He didn't want to cast so much as a twitch of aspersion upon the wisdom of the district attorney of Bronx County. Captain Ahab was obsessed with the Lamb case, and he, Kramer, still had the case in his hands. He still had a shot at that much-prized, ever-elusive, and in the Bronx, very nearly mythical creature, the Great White Defendant. On Fridays, the Tolliver School discharged its students at 12:30 p.m. This was solely because so many of the girls came from families with weekend places in the country who wanted to get out of the city by 2 p.m., before the Friday afternoon rush hour. So, as usual, Judy was going to drive out to Long Island with Campbell, Bonita, and Miss Lyons, the nanny, in the Mercury station wagon. As usual, Sherman would drive out in the Mercedes Roadster that evening or the next morning, depending on how late he had to stay at Pearson Pierce. Very convenient, this arrangement had proved to be over the past few months. A leisurely visit with Maria in her little hideaway had become a regular Friday night custom. All morning, from his desk at Pearson Pierce, he tried to reach Maria by telephone, at her apartment on Fifth Avenue and at the hideaway. No one answered at the hideaway. At the apartment, a maid professed to know nothing of her whereabouts, not even what state or nation she was in. Finally, he became desperate enough to leave his name and telephone number. She didn't call back. She was avoiding him. At the Bevardages, she had told him to call her last night. He had called repeatedly, no answer at all. She was cutting off all contact. But for precisely what reason? Fear? She wasn't the fearful type. The crucial fact that would save him, she was driving. But if she vanished? That was crazy. She couldn't vanish. Italy. She could vanish in Italy. Ah, that was preposterous. He held his breath and opened his mouth. He could actually hear his heart beating. Tick, 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 tick. Under his sternum. His eyes slid right off the computer terminals. Couldn't just sit here. He had to do something. The hell of it was, there was only one person he could turn to for advice, and that was someone he scarcely even knew, Killian. About noon, he called Killian. The receptionist said he was in court. 20 minutes later, Killian called from a noisy pay telephone and said he would meet him at 1 o'clock in the main lobby of the criminal courts building at 100 Center Street. On the way out, Sherman told Muriel a mere half-lie. He said he was going to see a lawyer named Thomas Killian, and he gave her Killian's telephone number. The half-lie was in the offhand way he said it, which implied that Thomas Killian, Esquire, was involved in Pearson Pierce business. On this balmy day in June, 100 Center Street was an easy walk uptown from Wall Street. In all the years he had lived in New York and worked downtown, Sherman had never noticed the criminal courts building, even though it was one of the biggest and grandest buildings in the City Hall area. An architect named Harvey Wiley Corbett had designed it in the modern style, which was now called Art Deco. Corbett, once so famous, had been forgotten except by a handful of architectural historians. Likewise, the excitement over the criminal courts building when it was completed in 1933. The patterns of stone and brass and glass at the entrance were still impressive, but when Sherman reached the great lobby within, something put him on red alert. He could not have told you what. In fact, it was the dark faces, the sneakers and the warm-up jackets, and the pimp rolls. To him it was like the Port Authority bus terminal. It was an alien terrain. Throughout the vast space, which had the soaring ceilings of an old-fashioned railroad station, were huddles of dark people, and their voices created a great nervous rumble, and around the edges of the dark people walked white men in cheap suits or sport jackets, watching them like wolves monitoring the sheep. More dark people, young men, walked through the lobby in twos and threes with a disconcerting pumping gait. Off to one side in the gloom, A half-dozen figures, black and white, leaned into a row of public telephones. On the other side, elevators swallowed up and disgorged more dark people, and the huddles of dark people broke up, and others formed, and the nervous rumble